Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When you buy anything, a dishwasher, a car, a lawnmower, you assess quality, you assess need, you assess price, and you make a decision. Price signals matter. But buying healthcare isn't like buying other things. Quality claims are hard to check, and price signals are tough to compare when someone else is paying a lot of the bills. This hour, On Point, how did the U.S. end up with the most expensive healthcare in the world and get worse results? You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the current state of American healthcare? Is more care always better? Are you getting the results you need from your provider? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Noam Levy, healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Noam, welcome back to On Point.
Nice to be with you, Ray.
Well, it just seems like a couple of days ago where people were waiting for key senators to announce their decision to oppose or support in a closely divided Senate. Mitch McConnell missed his deadline for bringing the Senate version of health care reform up for a vote. Where do things stand now?
Well, there's still a lot of backroom negotiating going on the Republican side of the aisle. Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell trying to get the 50 votes he needs to get some form of legislation that would roll back the Affordable Care Act. So we'll see when senators return to Washington next week where things stand.
Even if he gets to 50 and then the tie is broken by Vice President Pence, the Republicans are not home and dry, are they? I mean, the Senate bill is still, in some ways, different from the House bill?
That's right, it is. I think, though, there's an expectation that if the Senate Republican majority can get something out of the Senate, that the challenge of getting it through the House is significantly less daunting.
But the two bills would have to be harmonized before they go to President Trump.
They would have to be harmonized, and traditionally the way that's done, of course, is in a conference committee where the two representatives of the House and the Senate sit together and work out the differences. But this process, as I'm sure your listeners know, has been a bit unlike traditional lawmaking. It's happened very rapidly without the usual process of holding hearings and so forth. And I think there's some thought that if the Senate Republicans can pass something, the House could simply take up that bill, pass exactly the same piece of legislation that the Senate passed, and send that on to President Trump.
Has Speaker Ryan and Leader McConnell's task been made more complicated by a lack of public support?
I think unquestionably. I mean, if you look at the polling on these bills that the House and Senate Republicans have put together, it's abysmal. I mean, 20%, less than 20% public support for what the congressional Republicans want to do. I think they're, you know, these bills make very large changes to programs that a lot of Americans support, such as Medicaid. You know, the half-century-old government safety net program for the poor, which now covers 70-plus million people, including tens of millions of low-income children. When you talk about cutting a third of that federal funding for that program, people are sitting up and taking notice.
Now, I covered the debate in the Congress over the passage of the Affordable Care Act, and John Boehner and Mitch McConnell repeatedly asked President Obama when was he going to listen to the will of the people. Was the Affordable Care Act ever as unpopular as this AHCA
no.
is?
In a word, no. I mean, it's no secret that the Affordable Care Act has been controversial. It's been deeply polarizing, always much more beloved on the left than it was on the right. But for most of its life, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, has been a sort of even proposition for the American people. About half people think it's okay, about half the people don't like it. One of the interesting things, though, that has happened since the repeal debate began in January is that the Affordable Care Act has actually become more popular. Basically, the public opinion surveys showed almost no movement in public opinion about the Affordable Care Act over the last 7 years since it was enacted. But since January, it has been ticking up. I think in part as people have come to realize some of the things that it does that would be taken away, and I think perhaps in part because of it's being held up against what is being proposed as an alternative.
Noam, when does Congress return to Washington, and is there a next trigger date looming?
Congress is back next week, and then there really are only 3 weeks until they break for their long August recess. Again, I think the conventional wisdom here, and I want to say that with a caveat, because a lot of things are happening in different ways than many of us who've been in Washington for a while have expected. But the conventional wisdom is that I think that if Republicans can't get something to President Trump before they leave in August, then it becomes a big challenge for them to go home, have this health care, this very unpopular health care legislation sit out there, and then try to come back in the fall and do this. And increasingly, Senate Majority Leader McConnell and other senior Republican lawmakers here in Washington have indicated that they are concerned that the longer that this impasse over health care continues, the more difficult it is for the Trump administration and for congressional Republicans to turn to other tasks, not the least of which is funding the federal government going forward, raising the debt ceiling so that the government can continue to borrow money and stay open, and turn to what really is a more cherished goal by many on the right, which is major tax reform.
Noam Levy is healthcare reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, good to be with you.
Joining me now from Baltimore, Maryland, is Christy Ford Chapin, professor of 20th century political history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times headlined, "How Did Healthcare Get to Be Such a Mess?" She's author of the 2015 book, Insuring America's Health, the public creation of the corporate health insurance system. Christy, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for having me.
Well, if you are very, very, very old, like I am, you remember when people carried major medical insurance because hospital bills were understood to be potentially ruinous. But if you just went to the doctor for something or other, you just paid him or her in cash right at the moment. From then till now, what happened?
That's right. What I argue and what I found when I was researching my book is if you look back at the beginning of the 20th century, what you see up until, you know, at least the 1940s and into the 50s was there were a variety of healthcare models, lots of different ways of financing and organizing healthcare. So in some cases, you had unions running welfare funds, you had mutual aid societies contracting with physicians and hospitals, a particularly elegant model where prepaid physician groups, where multi-specialty physician groups acted as their own insurers. So the system we have today basically was created by the American Medical Association, which of course represented physicians. They were afraid of a lot of these earlier models because they were fearful of what they might turn into as far as putting third parties, such as unions or corporations, in charge of financing, and that could threaten possibly the physician's autonomy and pay. So they worked very hard to shut down these other models. They had physicians' licenses pulled, their hospital admitting privileges revoked, and instead, at the end of the 1930s, came up with this insurance company model to which you were referring, that started with major medical and such. It started the insurance company model because because the way it was set up was recognized to be so problematic, it was recognized from the beginning that it would drive up health care costs, that these original insurance policies were very meager. They did not offer a lot of benefits in an attempt to try to contain costs somewhat. And the reason it was an expensive model is simply because physicians were to have complete autonomy, and they were also to be paid on a fee-for-service basis, which meant for every single service or procedure they offered, even within one office visit.
But nothing seems to have worked to either control costs on a steady basis or control the increase in costs over long periods of time. We're looking at a system now where even if you go for a well-child visit, it can be, if you're in a PPO, very expensive.
That's right. So the struggle, I would say, between insurance companies and physicians to begin implementing cost containment procedures goes all the way back to the 1950s, when I found that the media was covering a crisis in unnecessary surgeries, tonsillectomies, appendectomies, and hysterectomies that were occurring that weren't necessary. Now, that's a case of fraud. That's not generally the problem driving up costs. More often is just a rationalization of physicians, and I can certainly understand the position they're in. I'm sure I would do the same of providing gold standard treatment, and that's running up a bill that physicians don't have to be concerned about, because then they're going to pass that on to the insurance company. So, for example, on the prepaid doctor group, or those are sometimes known also as physician cooperatives or direct pay, the physician has to be concerned for shepherding the resources of the system and concerned about the profitability of their group. And because of that, and those types of systems, what you see is they don't have incentive to ration care because they want patients to come and see them and pay a monthly fee. But they also don't have incentive to attempt to run up a bill. And in some cases, physicians are attempting to run up a bill, for example, to a commercial insurer because they're thinking this will help offset, you know, Medicaid payments, for example, that they view as too low. So unfortunately, cost containment turns into this kind of cat and mouse game where it's pulling insurance companies further and further into monitoring and even dictating how medicine is practiced.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking healthcare. Why is it so expensive and inefficient here, and how it got that way? You can join the conversation. How do you know if you're getting quality healthcare? Has your healthcare confused or frustrated you? Did you have it when you needed it? You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest, Christy Ford Chapin, professor of 20th century political history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She recently published an op-ed in the New York Times headlined, "How Did Healthcare Get to Be Such a Mess?" We'll begin this hour in Lexington, Kentucky. Earl is calling. Earl, welcome to the program.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Earl. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm 66 years old and worked hard all my life, and I've got a part-time or a full-time job now so that I can have health insurance. I'm all for capitalism, but I do not see how the capitalist system works with health care because we have too many people opting out. Even when I was young, I opted out. Medical insurance for profit is for a capitalist is not the way to go. We're dealing with people's lives and people's livelihood. A national health insurance to me would be the way to go.
Earl, you mentioned that you're 66 and that you're working just to have health insurance. At 66, wouldn't you qualify for Medicare?
Yes, I do, but it's more expensive than working full time.
Because you get it through your employer, it's actually a better deal for you if you keep on working.
Oh, absolutely. I say 50%.
Christy Ford Chapin, Earl was talking about opting out. Certainly, the Affordable Care Act was built around, as he alluded to, changing the shape of the risk pool. Did it work?
Well, one thing I was listening to with what Earl was saying, and I found really interesting, is he was saying a capitalist system doesn't work with healthcare. And I think what is so interesting, and this is even where we see Republicans struggling, is there seems to be this myth that pre-ACA, the American system was based on free and competitive markets, you know, with the addition of, you know, Medicare and Medicaid on the side. And that's just not true. As you could tell from the story I was explaining earlier about how the AMA created this model, I think it's really important for people to understand that this is a model that they created out of thin air, practically. They invented something that insurance companies were not excited to get involved with. They got involved with it for political reasons, to help the AMA fight federal intervention in healthcare, but it distorted the market in all kinds of ways. And the AMA fought against any kind of competitive market just as hard as they fought against socialized medicine. And this is in the past. Of course, the AMA has more recently changed their position. So the with the ACA, what we see, just as with Medicare, is that even though there are policymakers who would have liked to have undermined the insurance company model that we currently have that's driving prices up and fragmenting care, it's not a very easy thing to do because we have this system, this organizational structure that has been built up so much in the private sector. The policymakers in the Johnson and Kennedy administrations, they recognized this. They wanted to undermine the insurance company model. They realized that at that point, they didn't really have a choice. They needed to adopt it and build the program, Medicare, around it, and also appoint insurance companies to administer or help them administer that program. With the ACA, we see a similar situation developed. You probably remember the debates around the public option. That was an attempt to undermine the insurance company model, but of course, it didn't get enough votes. It didn't go into the final legislative package. And so, unfortunately, the ACA was also built on this insurance company model, and that's why we have seen the problems we've seen on the state exchanges with prices being very high, benefits that on paper look great, but if you have to pay a $5,000 or $7,000 deductible, the very types of people who are purchasing insurance through the exchanges, they simply can't afford that. And so the insurance is inadequate. And now Republicans are trying to turn a lot of people out of their benefits, and it doesn't even make sense from a conservative ideology point of view, is because they're not turning them into a free market. You know, they're not saying go work hard and purchase insurance. It's impossible to purchase insurance at these costs. It doesn't make any sense. You can tell there is something wrong with the system because nobody knows what the price of anything is.
Burlington, Massachusetts is next. Anne, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call.
What's on your mind, Anne?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Well, I wanted to preface my comment with the fact that, one, I'm fortunate to be covered by private health care through my husband's company, and two, I am a breast cancer survivor of 7 years. So 7 years ago when I was diagnosed, we were on a PPO plan from Blue Cross Blue Shield, which covered pretty much everything, including standard follow-up mammograms and MRIs. Recently, his health care changed. His health care insurance changed to Aetna because of a sale of his company. And when I went to schedule the MRI last night, I was rudely awakened by the fact that they said, oh, you have a $500 deductible now. And this was something that was really quite opaque when we were choosing our health care insurance, when we were given all of the choices of PPOs, HMOs, et cetera. And what I find is that the private insurance industry and the healthcare industry in general are very difficult to figure out what the actual costs are going to be. And on top of that, when I read about the possibilities of what's in the new healthcare bill and what that might trickle down to in the markets, things like, are there going to be lifetime limits and how will that affect me? Because that is quite terrifying to a cancer survivor. So that's my commentary, is that it's just so difficult for the average American to figure out what's the best option for their health care.
Because, and once you go into remission, you're not done. You have to get this kind of checking procedure for the rest of your life, right?
Right. I'm going to be in every year for hopefully no more than that for mammograms, and usually every other year for an MRI just to make sure everything's okay.
Professor?
Anne, thank you for your call. You bring up a good point. A couple points I'd like to make about employer provision. First of all, that right there is limiting choice. And it, you can hear Anne, you know, saying that they chose amongst plans. So her husband must work at a very nice company that offers maybe three, four, even possibly as much as five different choices. But that right there, you can imagine how it does make the market difficult to navigate and opaque, because these insurance companies are negotiating primarily with a large employer rather than trying to make their information easy to understand to the average customer. It would be like if you thought when students were thinking about, you know, graduating from college and going to get their first job, that they assumed they would be getting their car from their employer. You can imagine how that would distort the market. Another problem with employer provision that often gets overlooked is you see in the political debates this idea that we don't want to expand Medicaid or make benefits more widely available for the poor or the working poor in this case, as you see with the recent Republican proposals. But employer-provided healthcare is a situation where you have tax expenditures or tax benefits going to corporations for providing fringe benefits for their employees. That includes life insurance, pension plans, and also healthcare. So in that case, it's indirect subsidization, but a good deal of government resources that are being foregone in order to provide employees with these really good private insurance programs. So that's something that has to be kept in mind as we continue in these debates, that do we really want to direct that much resources to middle class and upper middle class welfare, but not provide it for the working poor?
Joining me now via Skype from Philadelphia is Wendell Potter. He was an executive of the healthcare company Cigna. He's now a critic of the tactics used by insurance companies. He's written about it in his 2011 book, How Corporate PR is Killing Healthcare and Deceiving Americans. Wendell Potter, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
How do you answer the question, how did healthcare get to be such a mess?
It just evolved. There was no national planning. Most of the other Western countries took some action to really create a system that works more, behaves differently, and actually brings the entire population into coverage. And we've never done that. In fact, there have been many forces that have worked against that. So we just kind of let it develop, and it has. And as that our system has evolved, we've seen the creation of many for-profit health insurance corporations, huge hospital corporations, and these they have become special interests that are incredibly powerful and are able to protect their profitable status quo in Washington, the state capital. So it began because there was no real planning, no real federal oversight. The American Medical Association and other organizations fought against that, and so we are where we are.
There are other countries, and I'm thinking specifically of Germany, France, and the Netherlands, where insurance companies were kept as part of the system. There's universal coverage, there's better results, and there's lower cost. How did they pull that trick off, and we're so far from those goals?
We are. For one thing, they are quite regulated. They have to offer standard benefits, particularly certainly in France. There is some competition, but the competition is on largely on service and extra benefits that are not part of what they are required to offer. And typically, they're non-profit. In fact, in most countries, they cannot be for-profit. I think the real problem began in this country, or at least one of the big problems, is when insurance companies began to consolidate, to amass power, and to convert to for-profit status. So that has been a big part of the problem here. And when you have a system that is not as regulated as you see in other countries. Now, insurance companies would beg to differ because they are regulated and certainly are largely at the state level. But nonetheless, there is insufficient regulation, or at least in this country, the ability of these companies to convert to for-profit status has meant that their shareholders are their most important stakeholder.
Christy Ford Chapin, is there a difference between the United States and the other countries I named in outlook, in expectation, in what I guess in an underlying way is culture. I was interviewing the head of the largest private insurer in the Netherlands, and he said he was one of the most highly compensated workers in the entire country, but that he would have been embarrassed if he was making money the way some of the insurance company executives in the United States were, and still being part of a system where not everybody was covered.
Yes, that's right. I would like to point out, if we're looking internationally, that if you think about the insurance company model, which is different in the ways that Wendell pointed out here in the U.S., with not having government intervention early on, having it done in a very patchwork manner that has led to a lot of the costs. But if you look at other systems such as Switzerland, France, and Germany that also have an insurance company type model, they are the number two spenders. Now they're number two, way far behind the United States of us being up approaching 19% of gross domestic product, and they're down between 11 and 13%. But they're still in the number two positions internationally. So that right there tells you some of the problems that crop up if you put insurance companies into the mix as third parties, add this extra layer of administration. And even in these countries where they have universal care, you see some of the same types of problems. So, for example, Germany had long had fee-for-service, but then they started changing the formulas for the way they reimburse physicians in order to contain costs, trying to keep physicians to prevent them from over-providing services. Now it's led to some concerns about rationing, but it's the same kind of conflict you see between the physicians and what were once friendly societies and sickness funds that behave as insurance companies do. You see that same type of conflict, the push and pull. So I think one thing that the history definitely has taught us is that you want physicians to be incentivized correctly. So it's the physicians deciding on the ground how medicine needs to be practiced, but they're incentivized to care about the overall resources, but that they're not either rationing or incentivized to oversupply care. And certainly, as you mentioned, Ray, culture plays a big part of this because people for decades in these countries, Switzerland, France, and Germany, have grown accustomed to the idea of the government providing care, whereas we certainly have a different political culture here.
In late June, disability advocates held a die-in protest outside Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's office in protest of proposed Medicaid cuts. Here's one disabled protester who continued to chant as she was led out of the building in her wheelchair by police officers. Allison Barkoff from the Center for Public Representation attended that same die-in.
People with disabilities cannot bear the brunt of these cuts. And the only reason these cuts to Medicaid are in this bill at all is to pay for tax cuts to the wealthiest Americans.
Well, tax cuts or no, Wendell Potter, are the people who have the least political clout, the ones who are possibly losing in this next chapter of health care.
No, it's absolutely true. My most recent book is called Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. And it is about the power of the entrenched special interests that are able to protect their profitable status quo, like the insurance companies that actually contribute to the problems of cost and lack of access, as I learned and came to realize during my time in the industry. The cuts that are being proposed don't really do very much at all in terms, in fact, they don't do anything toward controlling the cost of health care. And there is also this myth that we have in this country that insurance companies are somehow able to control cost. Or at least that's been the myth that we have believed for many years. It's not so well believed now because of the evidence is that they are not able to control cost. And they often don't have much of an incentive to do that. In fact, as healthcare costs go up, their revenues go up. And so consequently, there's more to convert to profits. And when you have a multi-payer system, none of the payers have enough membership, enough clout to really control costs. Among the most vocal critics of rising pharmaceutical costs are insurance company executives, which just shows you that they don't really have much power when it comes to controlling cost, whether we were talking about pharmaceuticals or the cost of hospital care.
We're discussing the messy, expensive state of American healthcare and how we got here. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about healthcare this hour, why it's so complicated and expensive in this country, and how it got that way. You can join the conversation. Have you ever felt shortchanged by your insurance provider? What's the most frustrating aspect of your healthcare? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Christy Ford Chapin, professor of 20th century political history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And in Philadelphia is Wendell Potter, former executive of the healthcare company Cigna. We're getting feedback from our listeners. Glenn writes, "There's no such thing as health insurance. No one can ensure that you stay healthy. All they can really do is indemnify you against medical costs. They cannot actually improve your health. Your health is up to you for the most part. The rest is due to your genes and to chance." One listener writes, "One part of the problem, which is rarely discussed on the left, is how much this costs the country. During the Obama administration, I constantly heard about how many people were now covered who weren't before. That's great. Rarely did I hear what it does to the national debt. Now, at least, the Republicans are talking about it. Wish they'd apply this thinking to defense, too." Another listener writes, "Get the insurance companies out of health care. They aren't priced to the free market. Most of the population cannot afford the present premiums, deductibles, and copays. Therefore, the market says the pricing is too high, yet they price it for the large companies who pay most or all of the premiums for their employees as part of their salary." Pikeville, Tennessee is next. Donna, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to go back to the pharmaceutical thing because that's a huge thing and it's rarely discussed. I'm a type 1 diabetic. I have been since I was 10 years old. I have no control over my pre-existing condition, you know, as it exists. But this past January, when I was informed by my insurance company that they would no longer cover the type of insulin that I'd been using for 20 years, my doctor, you know, he could still prescribe it, but that insulin is very, very expensive.
Give us an idea how expensive, Donna.
Okay. Before I got a decent job with decent coverage, my doctors gave insulin to me because it costs around $700 a bottle, and I need a bottle every month, at least one bottle. And I take two types of insulin, and both are that expensive. And, you know, the insulin I've been on for 20 years, you can't tell me they haven't recouped their research costs. Maybe they haven't recouped their advertising costs because, you know, that's one of their biggest expenses, the pharmaceutical companies. But the refusal of our Congress to even look at the idea of giving government the opportunity to negotiate drug prices. I could go to Canada and buy my drugs over the counter for less than $100 a bottle.
That's a long way from Pikeville, Tennessee, though. Christy Ford Chapin, talk to Donna about how pharmaceuticals are different from service at the point of provision.
Well, one thing that is actually interesting that is similar is exactly what Donna is saying, is if the insured chooses not to cover that medicine or service or procedure, it might as well not even exist. And this is a problem we see with the way, for example, physicians are practicing medicine. So if physicians find a better procedure, a better way to do it, a better way, a more efficient way to do something, they're just not incentivized to carry that through because they're always practicing with one eye on the insurer and how that they're going to be reimbursed. So of course this affects people like Donna. There are physicians attempting to move towards some of these old models. For example, there are some physician cooperatives where people pay their monthly fee instead of to an insurer to their physician group and instead just buy catastrophic insurance. In those cases, what's really interesting is those physicians themselves have negotiated with pharmaceutical companies and in some cases are able to offer their patients medicines for pennies on the dollar of what they of what the insurance company would be charged.
Wendell Potter, help me out here. This is one of the more perverse areas in our national system. Here's Donna in Tennessee. She needs medication for a chronic condition. Isn't it cheaper to the insurance company to keep Donna healthy and thus create an interest in making sure there's a steady supply of low-cost insulin to Donna, rather than making her really expensive with all the accompanying problems that come with undertreated or improperly treated diabetes? I can't figure out how the numbers add up with taking a chance, rolling the dice, that Donna would be sicker.
You have to keep in mind that insurance companies are betting on the chance or the likelihood that Donna will not be an enrollee of their insurance plan for very long. So there's not that incentive really to treat Donna, to make sure that she has access to inexpensive medication. They're very short-term focused. I don't know what her insurer is, but there's a very good chance it's a for-profit insurer that has to report profits every 3 months. And they are constantly under pressure to cut cost. And often that means putting medications in different tiers or not covering certain medication that their enrollees need. It's all a very short-term financial focus, and consequently the people who are most disadvantaged are people who are enrolled in their plans in too many cases. One of the things that we need to keep in mind is that we're often told that we need to have more choice of insurance plans. It's really misdirection. We could have more greater choice of insurance companies, but what are the trade-offs? We would have plans, as we're seeing now, that have narrow networks of providers. You may not be able to see a doctor that you need. You may not be able to get a medication that you need. You may find that your out-of-pocket costs are considerably higher than you would have ever imagined. So the talk about choice of health insurer and the focus on premiums is classic misdirection.
Lisa is calling from Austin, Texas. Lisa, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thank you for taking my call. I am the parent of a child with autism. 1 in 54 kids under 12 have autism. And you have to be a veritable expert in maneuvering insurance when you have a child with autism. Typically, insurance companies in the past, they might bill therapies for autism under mental health benefits instead of behavioral health or other, you know, or neurological condition. And the medical model for profit is just not a workable situation for people with autism. Autism has no cure. Typically, people will need support all their lives. And my family, prior to the ACA, like, I had composition notebooks where I had to write down the name and agent number and shorthand conversation of every person I talked to get coverage. And in one case, I had to actually read the legislation from the state of Texas to someone on insurance before they would cover my son's therapies. And post-ACA, it has been a lot smoother, albeit more expensive. My family typically is on the hook. We're going to be on the hook basically for over $10,000 per year in order to get my son the therapies he needs to hopefully live an independent life. So my concern is that 1 in 54 kids will need lifelong support, and this model just won't sustain them. So what happens to them? Are we going to go back to the 50s where they're just shut in institutions or shut at home? It's very worrisome to me. It keeps me up at night.
Christy Ford Chapin?
Yes, these are the heartbreaking stories that that really highlight some of the deficiencies of the current system we have. So what I want your listeners to imagine is if we could kind of go back in time and look at this particularly elegant model I was talking about, because it's hard to understand our system without comparing it to what it could have developed into or another model to understand what the deficiencies are. Physicians, it was more rank and file AMA members, not the leaders of the AMA, They set up hundreds and hundreds of these prepaid doctor groups, these physician cooperatives. And the very interesting thing about them is they tended to be multi-specialty. So for somebody who's in the position of the caller who has either, you know, a chronically ill member or perhaps a difficult-to-diagnose disease, you want to be able to have one-stop shopping integrated care so that the physician group that, you know, owns the patient, so to speak, has all the different services available there instead of the patient or the patient's parents having to navigate this specialist and that specialist. Now, are the specialists speaking together? And did the general practitioner make sure to talk to this other specialist about the medical regime and what medicines they're on and how do they balance them? That is lacking in our current system. Our care is fragmented. Sometimes people are just, you know, they go see their physician. The physician does everything they can according to what, you know, the insurance company allows them to bill for, and they have no choice but to send them on to the next specialist. They can go from specialist to specialist. They could die in between specialists and nobody even knows. You know, that feedback, that information doesn't even get back to physicians. So that's one thing that is certainly very concerning with this fragmented model we have where nobody really has the ownership that they should for any patient's health.
From our listener feedback, Kevin writes, "It's a mess because there's a lack of transparent pricing and cost information for consumers, which favors abuse. Not to mention, we've let health and pharmaceutical lobbies buy the laws that regulate them. We've created a recipe for disaster, and now we're living in it." One listener writes, "Oh, I can tell you why it's a mess. People are making a ton of money off the highest priced, least effective insurance system in the modern world, and I've got some news for you. All that money, insurance execs, shareholders, hospitals, pharma, etc., are never going to let that money dry up." Another listener writes, "Our healthcare is the most successful in the world. Unfortunately, though, our healthcare system is about making money, not delivering healthcare. But in that respect, it is better than any other." Wendell Potter, is Kevin right when he suggests that more transparent pricing and cost information would make a difference? Do consumers know how to comparison shop for healthcare? And would we? Do you want the cheapest heart surgeon? Would you put out a call or look in an index to find the cheapest heart surgeon?
We do have a need for more transparency. The lack of transparency certainly works to the benefit of the hospitals, the insurance companies, the physician practices. So they might talk a good game about wanting to have more transparency, but they work against it. And a lot of the contracts that insurers strike with hospitals in particular bar any price transparency. But your point is correct, Ray. Even if we had true price transparency, we don't really go shopping for hospital when we're in a crisis. Now, that said, if there were more readily available information, I think that would be somewhat self-regulating or require some self-regulating more than we have now. But the lack of transparency works to the benefit of the entrenched special interest.
Let's go back to the phones. Manchester, New Hampshire is next. Cassie is calling. Cassie, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yes, hello. Thanks, Ray. I appreciate you taking the call. So I'm calling because I actually believe that what's missing is that there's no tie-in between prevention and medical care and no responsibility for results. I've appreciated many of the speakers today. And because I know I had a brother with developmental disabilities, similar to that lady with her child with autism. And, you know, that's a long-term condition, and that's another thing. The short-term focus doesn't work for those people. And but not only that, the whole medical focus doesn't work because a lifestyle change is often very much part of reducing illness, symptoms, improving motivation, you know, all kinds of things. But there is no tie-in whatsoever with things that, like, even things like occupational therapy are just parceled out piecemeal, you know, as little and almost disregarded as little temporary things, when in fact those things can be helping tie somebody to community, to exercise programs. There's another program called Embedded Counselors, where they used, even with diabetes, for treating diabetes, they had people with diabetes trained as counselors, working in group programs to work with lifestyle change over time.
Cassie, let me put your point to Christy Ford Chapin. Would those inform our system and help us get better cost control? Prevention, monitoring of results, lifestyle changes encouraged by the system, would all these things help given our current state?
Yes, but I mean, preventative medicine, that's been something that's been talked about, you know, at least since the 70s as a way to get down costs. But again, it's kind of a Band-Aid on a broken system, because the best you can do is have insurers try to pay physicians for certain types of preventative care, but there isn't, again, you don't have the physicians motivated to figure this out. And I argue that it's the physicians. They're the ones with the requisite expertise to understand how to organize this on the ground. So, for example, if you had multi-specialty groups where the physicians acted as their own insurers, say up to $50,000, $75,000, and their patients had catastrophic insurance to kick in after that, they're the ones who would be motivated to think, hey, we need these education classes for our diabetics. Oh, why don't we go ahead and talk to, see if we can negotiate something to get them a cheaper gym membership. You see how they start to become motivated because they're tied to keeping their patients healthy is a motivation for them because of the fact that they're watching the bottom line. They don't want to ration care because they don't want to lose patients. So the best thing they can do is keep their patients healthy. That is a more natural way to incentivize physicians than, again, just these rules and regulations that are continually more and more handed down from insurance companies to physicians, and really are just more and more straitjacketing them. Medicine, the practice of medicine is no longer the art that it used to be. It's physicians can't be as innovative as they used to be because everything has to fit into these standardized boxes of what the insurers require.
Christy Ford Chapin is a professor of 20th century political history at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Wendell Potter is a former healthcare executive. Thanks for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, President Trump at the G20, North Korea on notice, state budget battles. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.